Cei bune băiți amici doși, mei dovelio meilu, se-n călcheilu de soiro seco. Bune băiți amici doși, mei dovelio meilu, ira tu-n mira bună cor soi.
Well, shalom and welcome to the second hour of 2 hours of Jewish Soul Music. I'm your host, Charlie Bernhout. This is show number 232 of January 13th, 2014. Well, it was a very busy week for me. Wednesday night at the Beit Orot dinner, and more about that in a few minutes. Friday night, attended the Yanky Lemmer and Sherwood Goffin Tisch at Lincoln Square Synagogue. Saturday, Shabbos morning, Zevi Muller and Simcha Leiner, wonderful, wonderful davening. And then the Saturday night, Cantor Benny Rogoznitsky at the Park East Synagogue Kumsitz. So it was very, very busy. And I'm so sad to report that on Sunday, I was at the Shiva for a dear friend, Marty Einhorn. Many of you know that I've been on the air since 1977, and one of the pleasures of doing this is the wonderful people that I meet and have met over the years. And Marty Einhorn certainly was a wonderful person, a saintly person, a great lover of Chazanis, to say the least. And he passed away on Friday. So, Judy and family, you have my condolences. Marty Einhorn of Brooklyn, sitting Shiva this week. Well, as I mentioned, I was at the Beit Orot dinner, and I ran into my friend, Rabbi Stephen Przanski, someone who I admire and have interviewed over the years, the last 20 or so years, and he's always right on target. So without further ado, let's hear Rabbi Przanski. I'm very pleased to have with me Rabbi Stephen Przanski of B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck. We just returned from a wonderful dinner celebrating Beit Orot. Shalom, Rabbi.
Charlie, it's nice to be with you again.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And one of the things that I always enjoy is when we are at the same wonderful events celebrating Israel. You know, it's a shame that there weren't more representatives of our people there.
Well, the room can only hold so many, but the Beit Orot dinner was actually pretty full. The room at the Crown Plaza in New York was packed, and dedicated people came out, and the organization does a wonderful job on Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, establishing their Jewish presence that really makes a difference in terms of the security of Israel.
That's for sure, and it's a pleasure to see the growth there. It's exciting.
That's correct. And each time we go, we see more and more. And it's not only a security issue, but it really makes a statement that the Jewish people intend to stay in Yerushalayim forever.
Yes.
And it sends that message unequivocally to the world.
Well, we're certainly facing a lot of pressure from our dear president and his secretary of state. And it's very disconcerting to see Kerry, you know, what do they expect Israel to do? Commit suicide?
It's disconcerting. I think even to backtrack a step, it's actually quite peculiar when you look at what's going on in the world and all the trouble spots in which Obama's diplomacy has failed, whether it's the turmoil in Syria, where tens of thousands of people have been killed, or in Egypt, or unrest in North Africa. the problems in Benghazi, even the scandals in America relating to the NSA, and not to mention America's strained relations now with Russia, with China, with Germany, and other erstwhile allies, you wonder why there's such an obsession with trying to diminish Israel's standing and contract its territory. It's very strange. Again, even to Israel's east, Iraq is now in the process of collapsing. I didn't mention Iran, which should be the number one diplomatic objective of America, to try to stop Iran's drive for nuclear weapon, not just to appease it until it acquires one. And yet with everything swirling about, I think Kerry goes to Israel for the simple reason that he feels comfortable enough that of all the countries with which America deals, Israel is the one most likely to make concessions. And I think that's where your adjective, disconcerting, arises. Why is it that Israel seems to be the only country that can't say no to an American demand? And it's not a demand for something frivolous. It's a demand essentially to surrender its heartland, part of its capital, to an enemy that's sworn to its destruction. This is both peculiar and disconcerting. And I think at the end of the day, if all we find is another peace agreement is signed, another piece of paper that undermines Israel's security and our claim to the land itself, then it's really for the shame of the Israeli government and the Israeli people that elected this government.
Uh-huh. Is it too easy to say that this is anti-Semitism?
I think it might be a little overblown. I don't think it's related to Jew hatred as much as it is what they call picking the low-hanging fruit. American diplomacy has failed in so many parts of the world that they see a fruit that's easy to pluck, and that's Netanyahu's diplomacy, his statecraft. For some reason, he seems to be over-eager to please Kerry, even to the extent of doing things that not only undermine Israel's security, but completely destroy the morale of its citizens, to wit, seeing dozens and dozens of murderers sentenced to life prison just walk the streets and return to their families and be celebrated in their communities, something that their victims, of course, cannot do. That's extreme weakness. That's the type of weakness that's unprecedented anywhere else in the world, to just have a demand made of a sovereign country that it release murderers of its own citizens simply for the privilege of sitting down at a negotiating table in order to surrender to its
right.
enemy.
Right.
That's
bizarre. And the sitting at the table is going to be a failure anyway. I mean, everyone knows that there's no chance for this to succeed.
Well, I think there's no chance of peace. There is a chance that an agreement will come out that will be couched in such a way that the Israeli public may vote for it. Who knows? Netanyahu is committed to bring any proposal that involves a surrender of land to a referendum. But we all know we have the sad experiences of Ariel Sharon when he had a referendum in the Likud before the expulsion from Gaza and the north of Samaria. And the Likud voted it down. And nonetheless, he went on anyway. So who knows what Netanyahu is planning as well, what the referendum would say. I hope they've learned from the past. I hope their memories extend more than just a few days or a few weeks. Doesn't even have to. Even in today's news, there are constant rock throwing and shootings and attempted terror that is caught and thwarted by the security services.
Right.
It's happening already now. So if they don't see it, that not only the events of 10 years ago and 15, 20 years ago, and all the terror and the terror war beginning in 2000 that took over 1,500 lives, if they think another piece of paper is going to bring them security, then, I don't know, maybe they are beyond help.
Yes. Can you imagine the United States letting 30 or 100 or several hundred murderers of American citizens free just to get somebody to sit at the table with us, to talk to us over a hopeless situation anyway. I mean, it would never happen
because that stems from national pride. That would never happen. I can only fantasize about America showing goodwill to Israel and finally releasing Jonathan Pollard after all these years.
Yes.
Especially in light of the revelations that the NSA has been spying on Israel the CIA has been spying on Israel for many years already. The fact that nations spy on each other should not shock anyone. Even that allies spy on each other should not shock anyone. But the fact that the United States government went overboard in prosecuting Pollard and demeaning Israel, knowing that it itself spies on Israel, so that's also beyond the pale. And if there was a normal relationship between countries, that is to say, if Israel had sufficient national pride to say, unless you release our agent, there's nothing to talk about with these enemies with whom you want us to negotiate, you show some good faith also. Show some goodwill and send our agent back home. If they can't do that, then it's also a sign of lack of national pride. But it doesn't speak well of American justice either.
It doesn't speak well of American Jews, who are pretty much silent about this also.
It speaks very poorly of American Jews, and that has been a problem since the very beginning. Frankly, the Israeli government has its share of the blame. We all know there are people in the embassy. Pollard was already in the embassy inside the gate, and he was turned away from the gate at the insistence of someone who now sits on the Israeli Supreme Court. And it was the highest levels of government that said to send Pollard outside the gate to be arrested right there by the FBI. So they were the first to betray him. And then, of course, you have many Americans ran scared because of the canard of dual loyalty,
as if
somehow if you have other agents of other countries, whether it's China or Saudi Arabia, or Egypt, or Taiwan, other countries, some of them enemies, some of them allies of America, who've also spied on America, and yet their people did not fail to rally around them and ensure that their sentences were very brief ones, it is a poor display of solidarity on behalf of the American Jewish community. You know, the average sentence for what Pollard pleaded guilty to, and rightfully so, he pleaded guilty, the average sentence spying, it's actually passing classified information to an ally of the United States, the maximum sentence anyone ever received for this was 4 years. 4 years!
Yeah.
And he's already in prison 28 years.
Wow. We hear that Sharon may be near death, and one of the things I've been doing is pulling out past articles written by him himself, by Sharon himself, where he said, Hebron is Tel Aviv, Gush Katif is Tel Aviv, and I don't have in front of me a dozen citations where he clearly stated that you could not trust the Arabs, that you shouldn't give in to the Arabs, you shouldn't give them one inch. And the great mystery is he had really been someone who I guess we all praised, that he would then turn around and give the order to destroy the Gush Katif settlements. I don't want to call them settlements, the towns, and destroy the lives of almost 10,000 Jews.
I think if he said that Hebron was like Tel Aviv and Nitzarim was like Tel Aviv, we should be thankful that he didn't have the opportunity to do to Tel Aviv what he did to Nitzarim.
Okay.
Sharon will turn out to be one of the most complicated individuals, complicated Israelis ever to achieve a position of power. And there's no doubt he did tremendous things in the first 30, 40 years of his public career, in war, in settlement. I mean, he was one of the moving forces in settlement from the earliest days of the founding of the settlements.
Right.
I just gave a lecture this past Monday night about the rise of the settlements, and one of the things I mentioned is that in an early attempt to settle Elon Moreh, which is one of the cities, one of the towns in the Shomron in Samaria, Sharon then was in the Likud in opposition, was a freshman member of Knesset, and the Rabin government, Yitzhak Rabin on his first term as prime minister in the 70s, 1974, sent troops in order to evict settlers who had set up a makeshift encampment. This was before it was finally approved. And Sharon ran at the soldiers when they came and said to them, refuse orders, refuse orders. These orders are immoral, because the soldiers were being told to evict Jews from their homes, makeshift homes, not the permanent houses and synagogues that they built in Gush Katif. So here he is, 1974, screaming at the soldiers, some of whom had served with him a year before in Sinai in the Yom Kippur War. He's screaming at them to refuse orders. And then 31 years later, he's saying what an outrage it would be, how divisive, how it would cause a civil war if soldiers refused his own orders to evict Jews from their homes in Gush Katif. Sharon, in various positions he held in his early years in government, whether it was as Minister of Agriculture, as Minister of Defense, as Minister of Housing, as Minister of Infrastructure, whatever position he held, he used it in order to increase settlement in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. And then to suddenly, in 2004, completely change on a dime. In fact, adopt the policy of his opponent in the previous election, Amram Mitzna, who was running for prime minister of head of labor, and he proposed an expulsion of the Jews of Gaza for the purpose of peace, and Israel should end its residence there. He adopted, and Sharon, during the campaign, decried, lambasted Mitzna for this policy. That's when he said, Nitzarim is like Tel Aviv. So just a year and a half later, to completely change and adopt the policy of his opponent, effectively undercutting the votes of the people who voted for him, it's outrageous, it's undemocratic, and I tell you, like you said, it'll be one of the greatest mysteries in Israeli history. How could he have changed? And especially in retrospect, when we see that the expulsion from Gaza not only devastated the lives of almost 9,000 people and destroyed beautiful settlements that existed there, homes, businesses, synagogues, yeshiva, just destroyed them, it also greatly impaired the security of Israel's south, which then over the ensuing years were faced with thousands and thousands of rockets, making life there almost unlivable, but for the hardiness and the spirit of the people who live there. How could he have not seen that? How could he have transformed himself overnight from an icon of the right to an icon of the left? How is it possible such a thing could happen? That's one of the great mysteries. But you know what? He spent the last 8 years already himself in exile. Exile suspended between life and death.
Yep.
Suspended between this world and the next world. So who knows? God has his own plans.
Yes, some would say he got his just desserts, but it's harsh to say. Rabbi Brzezinski, one of the things that I, of the many things I respect about you, is that you are not afraid to speak out. I go to quite a few congregations, shuls here in the metropolitan area, and it's rare that a rabbi will speak up, and I hear that they don't want to offend certain segments of the congregation, that they might seem that they lean one way or the other. They have to sort of shah still, and it's very, very upsetting to me. Israel could be falling apart, it could be attacked, there could be something outrageous happening, and you go, and as you know, Rabbi, every Shabbos, the Torah portion of the week speaks about our current day. You can take almost any Shabbos and take the portion and relate it to what's going on today in reality, and they failed to do that. It really upsets me.
I hear where you're coming from. I don't want to criticize my colleagues. Some of it is just personal style. Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it is the congregation, that they don't want to be upset. They don't want to be afflicted with uncomfortable ideas or challenges. But nonetheless, different rabbis have different styles, and I prefer to challenge, you know, not only speaking, but writing. And I prefer to have people have to think about ideas and sometimes to be a little uncomfortable, sometimes to have to wake up and realize that not everything is as pleasant around the Jewish world on Shabbos morning as it would seem from our perch in Teaneck. So we should be able to feel the pain of others, and we should be able to try to mobilize ourselves to ameliorate that pain as best we can. Certain rabbis don't do it. Maybe they temperamentally are incapable. Sometimes their congregants are incapable or not willing to hear it. There are rabbis who certainly have lost jobs for saying things that people don't want to hear.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, you know, thank God I've been very successful, very fortunate in having a membership that for the most part, not everyone, but for the most part, they're receptive to the message. If it was everyone, there'd be something wrong with me. So it can't be everyone.
That's
but, you know,
sure.
I don't see the job of the rabbinate is just to each week preach platitudes,
right.
Tell people what they know already and they believe already, because they don't need me for that. They just have to think of themselves and speak their minds. So they haven't learned anything. So I hope at least on occasion to challenge them and make them think a second time. And certainly to arouse people when it's necessary to be aroused and to be energized.
I don't remember if it was Lincoln who said, I cannot give you the formula for success, but I can give you the formula for failure, which is try to please everybody. And,
right, you can't please everybody. No. You know, I have a sign hanging in my office that I picked up once that it's the first thing people see when they walk in, and it says, for every action, there's an equal and opposite criticism. And that is true. Whatever you
sure.
do, someone will criticize. And then you you know, you do reference Lincoln's famous quotation that Lincoln had to make many momentous decisions during the Civil War, things that he did not know how they would turn out, whether the nation would wind up being destroyed or split. So Lincoln said once that, and I keep this up on my desk also, I do the very best I know how, the best I can. If the end brings me out all right, what is said against me won't amount to anything. And if the end brings me out wrong, 10 angels swearing I was right would make no difference.
Wow.
So at the end of the day, you just have to do what you think is right, and
yes.
the rabbi has to preach what he thinks is correct, what is the ideas and values of the Torah, and then God decides whether it was right or not.
Now, there was one thought that I believe you expressed when we spoke briefly at the dinner. It had to do with the fact that, I don't know whether it was Netanyahu or Sharon, the fact that they were not grounded in Torah.
Right. I mentioned my lecture the other night, and I've noted a few times over the years, something that perplexed me, I think perplexed many people on the right wing, of Israeli politics over the years. How is it possible that the basic dynamic of Israeli politics is that Labor proposes and Likud disposes? And Labor threatens to return land for a piece of paper, but it's actually Likud who does it constantly, whether it was Begin and Sinai, whether it was Netanyahu and Hebron, and Sharon in Gaza. So how is it possible that here in opposition, when they're running for office, they rail against the idea of concessions to the enemy? But then when they're in power, all of a sudden they're quicker to make tangible concessions of territory such that the Labor prime minister would never make. How is that possible? Rav Eliezer Waldman, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Nir in Kiryat Arba, once explained to me, I asked him this question in 2005, that how is it possible that someone like Sharon could just completely be transformed? And he said that the many Jews in Israel, religious and secular, who love Israel, Ahavat Eretz Yisrael, they love the land of Israel. It's a Torah value. But if there are two ways to get to a complete love of Israel, through the Torah and not through the Torah, if there are two ways to get to that destination, Torah and non-Torah, so you wouldn't need the Torah. You wouldn't need it. You have the non-Torah method. So he says, therefore, there's a difference between the Avat Eretz Yisrael of someone grounded in Torah and Avat Eretz Yisrael, someone grounded in secular nationalism. Someone grounded in secular nationalism, it has to stop at a certain point. And that's the difference between the two. And that's why when secular nationalists come to power, they find some time, some point, at which their Avat Eretz Yisrael is superseded by other considerations, such that wouldn't happen when and if a religious person rooted in the values of Torah would assume power. And the American diplomats, the world diplomats, Kerry today, all he's trying to do is help Netanyahu find his particular point, where his love of the land of Israel ends and where other values, or better said, illusions and fantasies, can supersede the values that he has. It stops at a certain point. Whereas someone rooted in Torah, it becomes almost absurd. Like you're asking to return the land of Israel. It's like asking Jews to change the Shabbos from Saturday to Sunday. It's like asking a man, I like your wife. Give me your wife. I want your wife. Sure, take her. Why not? You know, we'll compromise. We'll share. It becomes an absurd request that's not even seriously considered. That's for the Torah Jew.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Jew who's not rooted in Torah, sometimes other values will seem to make more sense, whether it's peace, whether it's non-belligerency, whether it's world approval, international acclaim, signing ceremonies, public relations, winning elections, avoiding prosecution, whatever it is. There's always a point at which they'll say, okay, we don't have to love it this much, we don't have to retain it this much. And it has to be, I think that Rav Oldman's answer is completely on target, and the proof is there's so many conflicts in the world. Go back even the last 60 years, there's so many conflicts in the world. Is there a case we can think of where a country that won a defensive war returns the land to the aggressor, the land from which the aggressor launched his aggression?
Right.
Is there another example in the last century? I'll tell you one better. Is there an example in the history of mankind where a country did that once, much less repeatedly, as Israel has done it? That's what's so bizarre about the process, and that's where you see the difference between the Torah and the non-Torah personality, the rootedness in the values of Torah versus a pride in Jewishness, a pride in Israel, and a pride in the land of Israel. But that pride and that commitment to Jewishness ends at a certain point.
Uh-huh. Well, Rabbi, I appreciate your taking the time to share your thoughts with us, and it's always just a delight to speak with you, and perhaps a closing thought.
Charlie, again, it's always my pleasure to be on the air with you. Keep up your good work and Helen's good work as well. We need the strong voices in media to counter the cacophony of the left that really threatens to drown out our voices and send Israel down a very, very dangerous path. I think if our voices are heard here and in Israel as well, and we give strength to those people in Israel who know they're heading down a very, very dangerous path, then I think the end in the short term will be good. The good news is that we all know in the long term it will be good when Messiah comes.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Be well.
Okay, shalom.
Okay, that was an interview just a couple of days ago with Rabbi Stephen Przanski of B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, New Jersey. Let's go to the Chazanis and hear the classic Kiddush with Benzion Kopfkagen.
Oh, schoi vi hab overom soin in a hilano.
Oh, no, keep down. Yiddish home, we have all grown fine in a heart of no.
Very pleased to have with me Shlomo Goldstein, who is a great fan of Chazonus, and I also knew his brother for many years, Shmuel Goldstein, who had the printing operation on 16th Avenue. Well, shalom. How are you, Shmuel?
How are you? Shalom Aleichem.
Shalom.
Pleasure to hear your voice.
First of all, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you became interested in Chazonus?
Yes. My parents, Aleichem Shalom, we lived in Providence, Rhode Island. But Yiddishkeit over there was nothing. So my father picked himself up in the Depression year, 1929, and came to Brooklyn, to Borough Park, at the advice of some Hasidic rabbi, Rabbi Twersky. And there was always music and singing in our house. In 1932, and we lived right near the big shul, the Sfadisha shul, on 14th Avenue and 45th Street. There was a great chazan there, Yossele Rosenblatt, Olav HaSholem. And I had the opportunity, together with my father and one of my brothers, to sing in the choir with them.
Wow.
I remember it very distinctly. He was not only a beautiful, wonderful chazan, but the way he looked like a Kohen Gadol with the white outfit on Yom Kippur. Yes, it was beautiful. People loved his davening, and I was proud to be a choir boy and even sang some duets with Chazan Yossel Rosenblatt, all of a show.
Oh, too bad we don't have recordings of that. That was must have been something. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you are a chazan yourself.
I started first from 8 years or so. I sang in choirs, and later I became a chazan myself. I sang in the choir. Nathan Cooperman was the choir leader with Moshe Osher, and I really loved the way he sang. He was a great chazan, and for a whole year I was on a contract with the choir. And I think I made a big $50 for the year. And I used to go to different shuls and the choir with Moshe Osher, who was fabulous. And Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, he davened in the Bronx, and there was a mob over there in the Prospect Jewish Center on Prospect Avenue in the Bronx. I remember the slichus, and the whole davening of Moshe Osher was just fabulous.
Well, Shlomo, you know, I know you're a fan of my program, and you know I appreciate choirs very much, and I feel that it's very sad that there aren't that many choirs for young men to get the taste of the real thing.
That's right. I used to listen to the Chazonim and watch them and absorbed everything that they did. And I remember living in Borough Park. There were great Chazonim in Borough Park. And I heard Oscar Julius choir and Meir Machtenberg and Yoel Feig and quite a few great choirs. They're not around anymore like that, but they were.
No.
And it was just, that was beautiful.
The recordings that we'll be playing, give us a little bit of background of how you came to make the first two recordings that we'll be playing.
Yes, well, my favorite song was Ela Devarim, who was made famous by Chazan Mordechai Hirschman, Olav HaSholem.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to it, and I absorbed it, and I sang it, and I love it. And every time everybody asks me, let's hear some nice Chazonish, I come out first with Ela Devarim. Matter of fact, I remember singing in the choir at a concert with the Chazon Hirschman.
Really?
It was just in the Yeshiva University auditorium. He had a concert, and I was in the choir. It was very famous, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, then you went on the radio.
Yes, I sang on WEVD at least 15 different times, offering my services for the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, RJJ, and my parents, may they rest in peace, recorded them as I was, every time I was on the air, and I gave them a lot of nachas. I still have the compositions that I sang on the radio on a reel-to-reel tape. And this one was taken off as a reel-to-reel tape. The second song, Zachor, also. And I had quite a few, a nice repertoire of Yiddish and Chazonish and Hebrew songs that I gathered throughout my career. And as a Chazon, I sang in the Bronx for around 10 years in two different congregations. And after that, I received a position in Cleveland for the High Holidays, and I was chazon there for 23 years.
Really?
Yes, and I left them because it was too hard for me to commute back and forth. So I left them. They wanted me continually because they enjoyed my davening, and I enjoyed davening for them.
Now, you're in Baltimore now.
Now I'm in Baltimore, yes. There's no big chazonim anymore like there were then. In Borough Park, I remember there was Chazon Quarton was in Temple Emanuel. Yossel Rosenblatt was in Svartish Shul. Chazon Malofsky was in the 16th Avenue Shul. It was just fabulous. All those great, and Hirschman was in Temple Bethel.
Wow.
So, and in Svartish Shul, they had continuous great chazonim as guest chazonim. Leibler Waldman, Berla Chagi, and quite a few, Kap of Kagan. And I heard them all, and I enjoyed all of them and swallowed them into my system and was able to become a fairly good chazon. People enjoyed my davening, and I enjoy davening.
That's great. About what year would this Ela Devorim have been recorded, the one that we're going to play right now?
Around 1954.
Okay, yeah. Let's play this and stay on. We'll have more comments in between the selection. So this will be a cantor Shlomo Goldstein, and it's a premiere on this program. We're hearing Elu Devorim.
Yes, sounds good.
Okay, let's here we go.
And the next number, Zachor, is a beautiful
right
number.
Right.
Devorim singing Lohem Ishiyo Atayu V'habikurim V'urayon Ugnilusa Tudim Salmu Toiro Gemilu tasu di misal mutoiro Eilu divorim Sheyein Elohem Ishiyu Oh,
Beautiful. We're listening to Cantor Shlomo Goldstein, and that was true soul music, Shlomo.
Thank you.
Very enjoyable, and it's interesting that it was your folks were able to record it off the radio.
Yes. When I finished singing, and I called them up on the phone, how did you like it? Oh, you discovered good.
I love it. There,
and I gave them nachas for
I'm sure they loved it. Yeah. I'm sure they did. Now tell us a little bit about this next selection, which is Zachor Gedank.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful written composition about the Hashem should remember what we went through, and he should send us a Gula Shalema. I don't know the composer, but it was a very popular, beautiful song, and it was in my repertoire.
By the way, I enjoyed the variety of your repertoire with Yiddish and Chazanis. It was a great and even a little Israeli. Yes, Hebrew. Yes, but will I? Let's hear Chazan Shlomo Goldstein with Zachor Gedank.
Mm-hmm.
Zechor, Adoishem me'oyolono. Gedenk, Gott was von uns geworden. Hab ich zu rei, jetzt verbunden.
Excellent. That was Gedenk. Zachor Gedenk.
Yeah.
I know the next selection, you tell me, Uwe Shofar Gadol, you sang with your brother.
Yes, we were in the house. I had a little portable organ, and I played, and we sang together. And the melody was a beautiful thing from Nisana Tokev, from Rosh Hashanah Davening. And Uwe Shofar Gadol.
Okay.
It was a beautiful number, and I'm sure the people will enjoy listening to it.
Before I play it, I just want to tell you that I used to go to Borough Park quite frequently, and in fact, I always mentioned when I would despair about the Jewish people, I would go on a Friday morning to 13th Avenue and see all the young girls pushing the baby carriages and with three or four kids trailing, and I said, "We're going to be okay."
Yeah, that's true.
That's the future. Yes, and I then would go into mostly music, and then I'd go into 16th. for Schwartz's I love Schmaltzering, and then I would stop in and see your brother, and he always he always was such a pleasant person, and I think he had his sons there, and he was a great lover of Chazanis, I know.
That's right. He used to play it all day long in his store, Chazanis and Numbers.
Yes.
He recorded off your radio program, beautiful programs, and he sent it to me.
Wow.
I was in Baltimore, and he was in Borough Park.
Oh.
And I enjoyed it.
Okay. So let's hear this Uwe Schoeffer Gadol.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
That was your brother singing along with you.
He was singing along, and he played that little organ that we had.
Oh, really?
In the house.
Oh, yep. It was lovely, really. Chazan, any closing thoughts?
Well, I enjoyed that career of being as a chazan and listening to the chazonish, and even today, whenever I have a chance, I put on a tape recorder to listen to Chazonim, and I even had some Chazonim who sang concerts in Israel. I videoed them, and I listened to them too, and it brings me lots of nachas.
Well,
and I hope that the glorious day of Chazonim should come back again, and you have a great part in it, in bringing it back and reviving Chazonim. And lots of good luck and shlocha to you for doing that.
Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
And thank you for sharing your music with us and your thoughts, and we'll be in touch. All the best.
Thank you.
Okay, shalom.
Bye.
Okay, this brings to a close this second hour of show number 232. This is Charlie Bernhout. You know how to reach me at cbjmusic@aol.com. cbjmusic@aol.com if you have any comments or requests. Okay, a little of Moshe Kuzovitsky with Shei Bona Beis HaMikdash. Well, shalom everyone, and thanks for joining with me.